You turn to the book of Esther again, in chapter 4. We're in our series, Ask the Exiles. And this is the fourth study in the book of Esther, but it's study number 23 in our series so far. As we've said before, the book of Esther is the only one in the Bible that doesn't mention God. None of the characters are said to be addressing God, or no work of divine providence is attributed by the writer to God. And yet, this story displays beyond doubt the workings of God, the presence of God. It's got God written all over it. We've learned that Esther, the Jewish orphan, was being raised by her cousin Mordecai, who was some kind of civil servant, minor official, living in quarters within the palace at Shushan. And the king Ahasuerus chose Esther to be Vashti, the queen's replacement, through a lengthy process of elimination. So in her first study, we use a question, as we always do, to form our thoughts around. And this is the question that we asked: have I something that God could use? The study that followed that then was simply around this: can I lose sight of who I am? It's been very easy for Esther, going to be the new queen, went into a new environment where she was very much pampered, and she had a lot of people at her beck and call, many maids and PAs and butlers and servants and all kinds. It could have been very easy for her to lose sight of who she was in the sight of God. Then last week's question was, does it matter to me what God thinks about things? And when God saw a group of people called the Amalekites, including descendants of Agag, he thought of them as enemies of Israel. That's what God thought of such people. And we learned in our story that Mordecai was expected to reverence just one such descendant of the Amalekites, a man called Haman. Mordecai knew that God thought of this man in a very particular way. And because of that, Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him, and that created a big problem, of course. Not just for Mordecai, but for all the Jews everywhere in every province that had been taken over by the Persians. The big problem that was created by Mordecai's action was that Haman was outraged. And he decided that he wasn't just going to annihilate Mordecai or even Mordecai and his family, but Mordecai and all the Jews everywhere. To make sure that his policy would be accepted by the king, he promised to advance an amount of money. And he had calculated that whenever the Jews were destroyed, whenever they were got rid of, and all their goods and everything were seized, that the state and himself would be well compensated for any loss. So in other words, they were going to pay for their own Holocaust. But here's an interesting thing. The book of Isaiah is a lengthy book, but there's about three sections we can divide it up into comfortably. The first section is full of judgments and woes. And then there's a little bit of history concerning Hezekiah. But then from chapter 40 onwards is what's generally accepted to be the comfort section in the book of Isaiah. And you know, it was written for exactly this period, for the people who were exiles, who were captives. It was written for them so that they might take comfort that God still has a purpose. And not only the immediate prophetic peak of this period, but even beyond that, to whenever God will still have a purpose for the nation of Israel. And in that section, we read this in Isaiah 54: no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. So Haman had his plans, but here was something that God had in mind: no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. Now, to decide on a day when they would carry out this Holocaust, they cast lots, Pur, from which we get the word Purim, a festival that is still observed today by Jewish people across the world. And that was to be on the last month of the year, the month Adar, that the Jews were to be extinguished. So that's the story so far. And that's why we read these verses at the end of chapter middle of chapter 4, the end of verse 8, I should say. Mordecai gave Hatak, that's Esther's PA, a copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan, that all the Jews should be destroyed, and to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king, to make supplication unto him, and to make request before him for her people. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. So in this morning study, we're going to use this question. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? In case I forget to add this, but you heard the announcements earlier on for helpers for Holy Bible Club, helpers for Children's Church and so on. We'll need helpers for morning break when it recommences. So think about this seriously, folks, this morning. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? We have now this very beautiful young Persian queen called Esther, who has heard that the man who brought her up, Mordecai, has taken to the streets in sackcloth and ashes because he's so distressed at what Haman has said he's going to do. She doesn't, of course, know the full story, and she sends out some new clothes for him, and more or less to say, cover yourself up. But he wouldn't be discouraged from this very public display of deep personal anguish. So then she sends Hatak out to find out what's wrong with Mordecai. What's at the bottom of this? And as we've just read there from verse 8, he not only told her the problem, but he said, you can do something about this. You can use your unique position to do something about this. What would Esther do, I wonder? Well, what were her options? Well, she could have just ignored Mordecai's requests. She's been queen for a number of years now. She's been living away from him. She could just pretend she didn't get the message. That'd never do, would it? But another option was that she might have blamed Mordecai for upsetting the status quo, because things were cushy enough for any Jews that wanted to get progressed in Persia. They could do. We'll eventually come to Nehemiah, and he was the king's cupbearer. So it was possible to climb the ranks. And here Mordecai, by simply refusing to bow down to Haman, he has upset the whole thing. She may have said, you're to blame for this, Mordecai. She may have resented him doing that. But not only that, now he turns around and places a huge burden of responsibility on her shoulders. She might have thought, hold on a minute, this is the Mordecai who told me to hide my Jewishness. And now when he's talking with these men in the gate and telling them why he won't bow down to Haman, he's explaining that it's because he's a Jew. Another option was that she might have seen herself as being exempt from any annihilation. After all, I'm the king's choice. And they don't know I'm Jew. So it would have been very easy for Esther just to keep quiet, to lie low, and to let others come up with better ideas than Mordecai's, and ideas that didn't involve her. Do you know, she might have also had another option. She might have thought that she's already made enough sacrifices. Hasn't she had to submit herself to this regime, a selection process through all the great beauties in the land so that the king could have his pick? Hasn't she put herself through all that? Hasn't she had to live apart from friends and family in order to do that, in order to just go with the flow? And she has to live that life in the palace confines 24/7. That's a sacrifice she's made. Not only that, she has also made another sacrifice, because earlier we read of Mordecai discovering a treasonous plot, and he said to Esther to let the king know, and she did that. So she's already made a sacrifice. You can just hear her reasoning these things and coming to the conclusion, I've done my bit. What's the question we're asking ourselves today? Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? I wonder were some of those excuses your excuses? You know, that position that needs filled within the church, that's because so-and-so did something. Or maybe you're thinking, I've done enough. I've been in this fellowship for years, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing... I've made sacrifices for this church. Verse 10 of Esther 4. Again, Esther spake to Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. Now, this is the days before there was any text messaging. So she has this man, and if you had such a person, you wouldn't need to text message either. You just had to click your fingers, and he went, and then he came back, and on it went. Verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know, this is her telling Mordecai, that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of this, to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told him Mordecai Esther's words. As we mentioned before, the king didn't exactly pester the queens that were in his palace. Esther has had a good think. She's thought about the danger that's involved in this mission of rescue. She feels the need to remind Mordecai of the risk that she would be taking. Isn't that sometimes what we're like whenever somebody asks us to do something? We go down a whole list of things. You know, do you realize what that would involve for me? You know, I might have to make a dinner early one night in the week. You know, I'm serious. Do you ever think about what the sacrifice Jesus made for us? The sacrifice of people like John Bunyan, the sacrifice of other martyrs who were trying to get us the Bible in our own. Have you ever thought about those sacrifices? She's telling Mordecai, do you realize the risk that I would be taking? Now, she doesn't say outright that she's not going to do what he has asked. But nevertheless, she wants to let him see that he shouldn't overestimate her influence in the palace. Excuses, we love them. And many of the excuses that prevent us from doing what we could, or maybe what we should, many of these are good excuses. Esther's letting Mordecai know that she's not in such regular contact with the king as he might think. They're obviously not living together, as many monarchs and their wives, they're not living together in the way a normal husband and wife live. And they're in and out of each other's presence day and daily and getting on each other's nerves. It's a very different scenario in the palace. The king isn't pestering her to attend to his needs. He hasn't called for in 30 days. And she's wanting to let Mordecai know that, look, I just can't do this when you say. In short, she's really saying to Mordecai, palace life is complicated and it's risky. So I think her excuses were certainly good. But God doesn't look at excuses in the same way that we do. Because most of our excuses don't contain a reference to God. It's usually all about us or others. Remember, Moses had a good string of excuses, and they were good. First one was, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? There's another of those parallels that we've mentioned before. Although the book of Esther doesn't contain the mention of God or God being at work yet, there's lots of the things in the book of Esther we see in other stories where it most certainly is attributed to God. Moses is saying, I'm not good enough. I'm not the one to do this. Lord, you've got it wrong by convicting me. What was the Lord's answer to Moses? I will be with you. Now that makes all the difference, because that gets rid of all our excuses. I will be with you. So it's no longer just you. There's an amazing partnership here. It's you and God. Are you going to say no in a partnership that's you and God? Because one with God's a majority. Isaiah 43, lovely words, you'll know them so well. God said this, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. I will be with you. Paul, writing to Timothy, says, the Lord stood with me. Excuses, even good ones, are not so good when we forget that God's with us. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? Here's a story some of you will have heard before. And I wish I could memorize this, but I always get mixed up in it. But here we are. You'll see why. It's about four people. Here's their names. Everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. Right? Who's heard this one before? Only a couple of you. Right. Well, here's the story with these four characters. There was an important job to be done in the church, and everybody thought that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought that anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. Are you keeping up? It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done. It's very true though, isn't it? Very true. When a need arises within the work of the Lord, what goes through your mind? Because remember this, it will have originated in your heart. You got that? When a need arises in the church, this assembly, and we have needs for personnel, what goes through your mind will have originated in your heart. What are your options? Is one of your options, oh, ignore the challenge. Another option, blame somebody else for creating the vacancy in the first place. Remind everybody and yourself about the sacrifices you've already made. Think of other people who don't do very much at all. They should do it. Transfer the guilt to them. Are you ignoring the uniqueness of your God-given position of influence in this particular situation? Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? Verse 13, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Mordecai was sending a message to Esther that if she does nothing about it, and she still ends up being massacred with him and possibly all other Jews in Persian-controlled Babylon, then from God's perspective, the preservation of the Jewish race will have to come from somewhere else. He's not going to let that go. One possibility is that the returned Jews in Jerusalem, which are now a regional group, that they will be spared by some act of divine intervention, and therefore God's prophesied plans and purposes will still stand. But here's what we read in verse 14 again. If thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, thou and thy father's house will be destroyed. Mordecai, by saying that, is dispelling one myth that Esther might have had, that she would be safe outside of the will of God. You get that? Is there somebody here today and you're living outside of the will of God? You know, that's one of Satan's most successful deceptions amongst professing believers. To make them think that they can live as they like and they'll be okay if they're living outside of his will. If he has asked them to do something and they're saying no, and yet they think, oh, I can do that and I'd be fine. If we were to go through the personnel records of missionary organizations or evangelistic movements or even church denominations, and you were to go back 10 or 15 years and you were to make a note of all the names of all the candidates and trainees and workers, and then follow their progress, you know what you're going to discover? This is sadly very true. A vast percentage of them are no longer in that work. And the reason a vast number are no longer in that work is because they hadn't been called. They had no clear word from the Lord. And as soon as any kind of difficulty came, they were gone. An investment had been made in them. Support had been raised. Prayers were being given up for them and from prayer groups and all sorts of things. And they're gone. You see, they made the mistake that just because they're saved and they're active and they want to do something, and that they can just make those decisions and choices without asking God. And then they think that they can do that outside of his will and everything be okay. It's not going to be okay. Think of Christian marriages. Oh, we're both saved. That's enough. How many actually said, Lord, is this your will? Think of college and university choice, career choices. Lord, what would you have me to do? Because by ignoring God and not allowing him to tell us what to do, we think we'll still be okay. It's unsafe to live outside the will of God. And even though you may suffer and come and experience all sorts of things in the calling that God has given you, it's still the safest place to be with regard to who you are with him and regard to what he will do in keeping you. And blessing you and continuing to pour his presence and spirit upon you. Mordecai was reminding Esther that it was safer to take a stand for what's right, regardless of the risk, than to risk not placing herself at the disposal of God. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? If thou altogether holdest thy peace, back in verse 14, who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? That's one of the big, most famous statements in the whole of the book of Esther. Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Literally, it's no coincidence that you are queen at this particular time. Timing. Esther is given an opportunity to use her gifts, her qualifications, and her influence, but it's at this particular time. This unique arrangement, a young Jewess as a queen in Persia, this unique arrangement is not by chance. When was there ever a Jewish queen in an empire like this? When was there ever such a threat to the Jewish people from an empire like this? And the two things come together at exactly the same time. It's pretty obvious, isn't it? Who's at work? Verse 15, then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. So she's texting him back. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, fast for me. Neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also, my maidens, will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. There's the second most famous line in the book of Esther. If I perish, I perish. Now, if that statement was taken out of its context, it sounds very fatalistic. But what do we read immediately before she said those words? I want you to fast, fast, fast. That makes all the difference, you know. And now they're not so fatalistic. She has asked for something to be done because she believes that what she's asking to be done will make a difference. Now, it's as if the writer, as we mentioned before, had already written in pray and fast unto God, cry on, and then cut out all the bits unto God. Because when we read of fasting in situations like this in any other place, there's your parallel again. It is fasting and praying and calling upon God to show how earnest you are before him. If we take God out of the equation here, then what's that fasting all about? It's only a weight loss diet. That's it. What would be the point of that? Of course it is. What we read of in every other place, praying and fasting. What's our reason for fasting in Monkstown Baptist Church? Well, we've explained it before. With fasting, we are letting go of the flesh. Even if it's only for a day, for a meal, or electronic gadgets and TV and all sorts of influences. We're letting go of the flesh with the fasting. But at the same time, we're not leaving a void or vacuum. We are laying hold of God in prayer. Esther is going to use her influence, but it's a God-given influence. However, she isn't going to use that God-given influence as a fleshly tool. She's going to use it in complete and utter dependence upon God. Verse 17, Mordecai went his way and did according to all Esther had commanded him. That's interesting. Verse 2. As I said before, this book's full of contrasts. If you sat down to write them all out, it's another book in its own. Because once it was Esther that we read of who did all that Mordecai commanded her, I see how this little verse says he went and did all that Esther had commanded him. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? Now it came to pass, chapter 5, verse 1, on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against the gate of the house. No mention of God, but the number 3 in the Bible is significant because it speaks of the triune God and it speaks of God the Holy Spirit. So here's a little mention of something there too, the number 3. But those 3 days' wait must have been horrendous for Esther, mustn't they? And eventually the moment arrived. She gets herself positioned. She finds the best possible spot because she hasn't been invited in. But she wants to make sure she's visible to the king and that he will notice her and that he will invite her to come into his presence. She wasn't going to go up and knock the door and push the servants aside and present herself. She had thought this through. And there she was in the best position possible. Not only that, she had put on the royal apparel. And by including this detail, the writer's letting us know that there were a number of things that had to be observed when approaching the king in public. She's aiming to please. She's putting on the royal apparel. She's fit for that royal place. Do you remember Vashti had to be asked to put on the royal regalia? Mind you, the way some commentators describe Vashti, you'd think the king had asked her to take something off, which he didn't. He asked her to put something on. Esther's giving this her best shot. She's coming in the royal apparel. She's standing where she'll be noticed, but in the least offensive way. This is a dangerous move. But she has fully embraced it, and now she's in the moment. And you'll have to wait till next week to find out what happens. Our time is gone. I trust that these wee talks will help us as we think about our own lives in light of what we read in the lives of the exiles. But remember our question. Go home with this in your mind. Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do?